This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing, my chance to talk with artists, policymakers, and performers, to hear their stories, what inspires their creations, what decisions changed their careers, what relationships influenced their work. A new book called Dating Tips for the Unemployed follows its hero, Iris Smiles, as she haplessly meanders through New York City, looking for love and work, and then finding darkly humorous ways to sabotage that love and work. The book's author is also named Iris Smiles. She's earned her reputation as a wickedly funny chronicler of disaffection, family dysfunction, and self-loathing. Smiles was precocious from a very early age, with highbrow literary tastes in the fifth grade, although she found her love for the classics via an unexpected inspiration.
There were these cartoons of Mr. Magoo, and it was like Mr. Magoo does the classics. And there was one adaptation of Moby Dick where Mr. Magoo plays Ishmael, the lone survivor of the Pequod.
Of course.
Who in this case is a 70-year-old, you know, man going blind. And
yeah, this blind, deaf millionaire.
He's the only one.
He's
the only one who survives. Anyway, I was so taken with it. I was in fifth grade. So I went to the library and got the book, and I was trying to read that. And then my school teacher saw the book on my desk and started laughing at me, which I thought there was a gentler way to suggest that maybe it was a bit advanced. But I showed him.
Where did you grow up? What town?
In Dix Hills, Long Island.
So that was very, was it very wooded back then? Because you said you'd like to, quote, go around and climb trees.
It wasn't really that wooded, but I found the trees, and those I climbed.
All three trees in that block, you climbed them.
It was somewhat, I mean, there were trees around. It was a suburb. But also, Dix Hills, interesting, is where John Coltrane went to die. I found that out recently. I'm not sure why he went there.
Is that near your house? Were you there when he died?
No. But also, and also, it's near, speaking of literature, I grew up on Ibsen Court, which all the streets on my block were named after authors.
Yes.
But no one knew, because I think the planners of the town had these like high hopes for the people who would move in, and instead it was just all of us, and it was more mall culture. So
they thought it would be like a bunch of literary.
Right. So, for example, I grew up near the Walt Whitman Mall because Walt Whitman's birthplace is in Melville, but no one knew that Walt Whitman was a poet. So when it came time to learn about Walt Whitman in high school, everyone was like, oh, this guy's named after our mall. He must not be that bad.
Are your parents super brainiac people? Are they like reading all the time and playing opera in the house? You live in a very cultivated house?
No. No culture.
No culture?
No, actually, that's not true. Well, my parents were working so much when I was growing up.
Do you have siblings?
I have two older brothers.
So you have two older brothers and then you?
Yes. But my father was a big reader, and so, but we didn't have any books in the house because why buy them when you could borrow them from the library? So in the summertime, we would go to the library and like get a whole bunch of books on long loan, and then we would take them with us to Greece, where my mother's from, and read them over there and get them ruined on the beach, which always excited me because I thought I'm going to bring the books. I brought the books back ruined, but I thought I was bringing them back with the secret history and how lucky for someone else to have
this
them after they've been all over the world.
This is just ordinary water stains on this book.
Right.
There's some grease. Now, so your own connection, which lives on now, correct? You live in Greece part-time.
Well, I really just say that to make myself sound more interesting.
Right. How much of what you say is just to make you sound more interesting, and how much of it is fact?
Very little of what I say is to make myself sound more interesting, but some of what I write is to make myself sound more interesting. So I never would have said I live in Greece for part of the time. But I did write that in my bio to give myself a little extra glamour. Okay, I live there like 3-4 months of the year.
You do now?
Yeah, except for right
that's
now.
That's a fact. That's
right
true.
Right now I'm here.
Now, what did your dad do?
He growing up, my parents had a party store, but...
did they really?
Yeah. I grew up with all sorts of... I mean, I thought that that's what they were into, so I really embraced that hard and was really into partying for a long time. But it turns out it was just like they got into it accidentally. They're just, you know, business people. So
you're talking about like a kid's party store with like
They'd sell party supplies and novelty items. So, like, I grew up
with... Joy buzzers?
Yeah, a lot of whoopee cushions around my house, like, tons. We've only recently gotten through all of them, you know? Yeah, I didn't have a lot of, like, my parents weren't into material objects, so I didn't have, which is important in suburban Long Island, I didn't have, like, the best clothes, but, like, on Halloween, I was the best dressed. Yeah. Like, the only, every other year was, like, a nightmare for me. I mean, every other time of year, all the kids would, you know, tease me, but on Halloween, it was like, I had everything.
You were a god. Yes. You were a goddess.
Yeah.
I don't want to say, were you close to your parents, but you think your parents understood you? Did they cultivate sides of you that are, have kind of... evolve now, your writing? Did you show your parents your writing and did you share with them stuff you wrote?
No. Well, my
Were you writing back then?
I was. I was always writing a journal, and my father asked me once if he could read what I was writing, and so I said, okay, but after I die.
Because you wrote, I really want to kill my father.
No, it was just, that's how it's
probably
done.
Better you didn't.
You know, my posthumous papers,
sure.
you don't publish your journal before you die. Although I have published a selection of my journal in my upcoming book. I just slipped it in there just to promote it.
But you wrote a journal and you didn't share it with anybody.
No, that was the whole, you know, the whole point of it. And that it would be published posthumously.
Right. Is it?
But now
rather
I'm not
in a
sure,
safe place.
I'm not sure about that anymore. I mean, that was my idea when I took it up in fourth grade.
Right.
But, you know, my legacy, as every fourth grader should be concerned with. But in retrospect, I'm not sure it's such a... I've been looking over the pages, and I'm not sure if I actually am going to publish them. After I die, I might have to destroy them.
You started writing that when you were how old?
Fourth grade, I think.
What kinds of things did you write in fourth grade?
Well, that's... you'll just have to wait, Alec. Right.
Give us just a vague notion of what you wrote. Was it all about, like, you know... Today I walked home from school. It was cold. You know, or was it beyond that? Was it like...
Well, it changed. So sometimes there were crushes, right. A lot of crushes. I think, which you might think sounds adolescent, but that's what the romantic poets
were
doing.
Oh, no, I don't. Yeah, no, I don't think that's adolescent at all.
So there's a long tradition of that sort of thing. You know, and then I was trying to work on my descriptions for a while. So I would describe water and trees.
How many pages?
Mostly it's the good stuff.
We need to edit down this book, I think. We need to edit it down.
It's volumes. Yeah, I don't think I'm actually going to publish it anymore. That was the idea then, though. But one time I had, when I first came out of college and I had started, I wanted to be a writer, and so I had written this thing, and I had this idea. I told my parents, you know, instead of getting a job, I'm going to be a columnist, because that's really easy.
Is it?
No.
Right. Like, it's just what you said. What you say and what's real are
well,
just
no,
two.
I mean, that's I was at the point where I thought you just want to be something and then you do it.
Right.
So I had read them this thing that I had written. I mean, I thought it was funny, but their faces kind of just fell because it was really depressing, it turns out. Anyway, the point is, don't show your work to your parents. They won't get it. Because they just look at it to sort of, like, figure out what's wrong with you. You know, like some kind of Rosetta Stone to, like, where they failed, rather than seeing its literary merit. Like, you know, where they failed is pretty much where my writing succeeds, I think.
And neither of them were writers, ever?
Well, my father's creative. So he used to write and to do different kinds. He has a sort of artistic temperament.
When does your writing change beyond the... journal that we're never going to be reading?
Well, I guess I didn't really begin writing properly until I was around 28 or 29. I mean, I was writing before that and fancied myself a writer, but I didn't really become I was kind of more of a dilettante.
And what changed? What were in the gap between 10 and 28, what were you doing? You went to college for what?
Oh, I went to NYU to study acting.
What were your feelings about that?
Oh, it was, you know, I wanted to be an actress, but there was a lot of time there. I missed academics, you know, especially at NYU. It's a conservatory program, so it's a lot of money to be pretending to be in a large body of water or holding a coffee cup for like hours and hours every day.
Yeah, those are exactly the two analogies I always mention to people. I say, you're hip deep in some viscous substance. Now let's change the viscosity and change and change. And then everybody wore black clothes and smoked and drank a lot of coffee.
I did that for 2 years, principally because...
Did you go to a studio?
Yeah, I was in the Strasbourg studio.
So was I.
Really?
So that's why you say hip deep in gravy and drinking coffee.
Yeah.
That's what I was. You went to 15th Street?
Uh-huh.
Oh my, who were your teachers? Irma Sondry?
No.
Marcia Halfrecht?
No.
Are Jeffrey
you making these names?
No.
Oh, yes, Jeffrey Horn.
Horn. He was my teacher, Horn.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I mean, that was, I enjoyed it. I just wanted to study more things while I was in school. And then I kind of got away from it. I think it was a very good thing because I guess as an actor, you have to audition a lot. And I don't think I guess that's your real job, not actually acting. I mean, for most people. Few people actually have the opportunity.
I think that's potentially right, and I also think that the job is really what do you do with yourself when you're not acting.
Yeah,
and I always say to people the task is to find out how much you like acting because you're going to get to do so little of it.
So what I found out when I was at acting school and why I stayed with it for 2 years is I had discovered the nightlife in New York City, and I had never had a social life in high school because I had so many. You know,
God, you're my doppelganger. Keep going.
Really?
Exactly what happened to me. I'm in New York. I got a couple bucks in my pocket. I'm like, let's party.
Yeah. Well,
let's get wasted.
It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
And I mean, as a young woman in New York City, you're really sort of taken up. And I was weird in high school, you know, because I was really too enthusiastic. I was involved in all of these extracurricular activities.
Such as?
And I was I founded the debate club with one other student. He was the president because he was a senior, and I was the vice president because I was a freshman, and we were the only members. There was the Club for Independent Thought. There was the drama club, of course, and then I was president of my class. And what else? Oh, I was in the kick line, the dance team, the swim team. I was in running, but then my knees gave out. So I was just really busy all the time. But then when I came to college, it was like all of a sudden you don't have to do anything. You barely have to go to class. There's no work required of you. Yeah. So I was like, oh, now I can just. So the real work was at night, you know, going out, being out until like 5 in the morning.
Yeah.
And sort of.
Where would you go?
At that time, let's see, I remember the first time I went to a nightclub called Chaos, and it was like the world broke open.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I was so weird in high school, but then all of these men, they thought I was so sophisticated and interesting. That's
right.
What they said.
Right.
I understand, you know. Yeah. And they were like, you don't seem 18. I thought for sure you were 21. And I thought that meant I was sophisticated. They were just saying, like, I thought you were, like, legal and on the
right.
Level,
yeah, yeah.
That I could feed you drinks and I wouldn't get in trouble.
As I'm passing you this Manhattan.
Yeah.
When you stopped going to the drama program and you transferred to Gallatin, correct?
Yes, that's right.
And when you transferred to Gallatin, you studied philosophy and literature?
Sort of, yeah. Yeah, that's basically.
What did they call it at Gallatin?
They call it individualized study. So basically, you could just
read a lot of books,
string together. Yeah,
just read as many books as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you left in your heart, you left acting. You did not only leave the acting program. You decided I'm not going to be an actress.
No,
or did you not do that?
I figured I'd be an actress after college, but I just didn't need to do that
to study acting.
Yeah, I could do that later. But then the further I got from it,
so you went 2 years to Gallatin, and you were studying independent thought. Were you writing? Then?
I was writing poetry.
Right. But you discount that and say no serious writing till 28. Why?
No, I was writing somewhat seriously, but I mean, I wasn't writing with the kind of rigor to really put together a body of work. You know, I was dabbling or calling myself a writer. But I mean, you really need to put in many, many hours, well, hours every day to be a writer consistently.
Sure.
So before that, I just did a lot of drinking and talking about writing and then, you know, a little writing.
And when you say you did a lot of drinking, was that something that you were doing with groups of people, with friends, and it was all social and carefree and reckless? Or were you like going home and cracking open a bottle of Old Smuggler and having that at 4 in the morning by yourself? Or both?
Yeah, both. I mean, I guess when I first started drinking, I actually started drinking... I guess there were a few times where I drank alone, mainly because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't doing it out of peer pressure.
Right.
Do I really enjoy this? It turns out I did.
I don't need you to do this.
yeah, but I mean, it was both social and, you know, and then eventually it's great all the time.
And were you crushing on these men that were trying to buy you these Manhattans when you were trying to figure out if you were really 21 years old?
Some of them I liked. I guess sometimes I just liked that they liked me, you know. Right. It's always...
You wanted to be adored.
Yeah. Doesn't everyone?
2 years at Gallatin, so you're done after 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you leave college and you say you want to what?
Well, I wanted to be a writer, obviously, at that point. I mean, I always wanted to be a writer.
So acting's over.
No, I still wanted to be an actor. I mean, and I had thought maybe I'd be a movie star to support my writing. You know, reasonable stuff.
There you go again.
And then I had an idea to maybe be a business mogul to support my acting, right, which would support the writing.
Right.
So there
was no human rights work involved. It was all business mogul, movie star.
Yeah. Well,
Saudi princess.
I was a teacher. I taught. But I didn't do it for any good reason. I mean, I was teaching with Teach for America teachers and teaching fellows at a troubled school in the South Bronx.
How long did you do that?
I did it for a year, and then the school was taken over by the state, so they got rid of everyone. And then I went to a different school.
How many years total teaching?
Two. Two that I was teaching middle school.
So you took 2 years to teach for no good reason.
Well, because I think I needed a job. I mean that I didn't have any good intentions that I was going to save anyone. But I think this is why I lasted at this public school, because all of the Teach for America fellows quit within a month because, you know, they were being threatened and things like that. So
were they being threatened by the students?
Yes. I eventually ended up having to teach gym, too, because both of the gym teachers by the end of the year were jumped. I mean, it was a very rough school.
Really?
Were you
assaulted at all?
No, but I was often sore from breaking up fights.
What was it in your mind that you thought you were born to referee fights among middle school children in the Bronx?
Well, I just needed.
I mean, I just have this image of you being like, you know, here now, enough of that, and you're like stepping in between like somebody with a broken bottle and a chair.
No, actually, one time someone did have a chair over another kid's head. That wasn't one time.
How many fights did you break up during your 2 year career?
Oh, it was multiple times a day.
Right. And then ended after 2 years. Why?
Well, in order for me to escape to graduate school.
And you went to graduate school where?
I went to City College to study writing.
For how long?
I tried to stretch that out as long as possible. Again, I mean, that's why I say, first of all, the truth is graduate school is most of the time, unless someone's becoming a doctor, it's pretty much a shelter for kids who just don't want to grow up.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why I had even considered a PhD, because I was like, I'm just going to make this last forever.
Yeah.
But so I was there for a few years. I was also teaching in the, I was teaching undergraduate humanities and creative writing at the same time.
And all the time you're doing this, what's funny to you? What's entertaining to you? What's humor to you? What are you reading? What are you watching, listening to? Did you go to the theater? Did you go to the movies all the time?
Well, I've always been reading all of the time, but...
What were you reading? What were you reading that was funny?
I don't know. Perhaps a little bit of Donald Barthelme. Celine, Journey to the End of the Night. I've never really read anything that's been exclusively funny. I like things that are very, very serious, but that make you laugh consistently, because I think that that's more truthful in how life is, or at least that's how I experience life.
Were you a moviegoer?
Yeah, I like to go to the movies alone. That sounds so sad.
It sounds perfect. Well, you don't need anybody to go to the movies. It's
no,
you.
No, I don't understand.
There's a whole world full of people up there on screen.
Why do people go with other people? They just chew and then they look at you and you can hear them breathing. I don't understand going to the movies with another person.
I love going to the movies alone.
That's the way to do it. And if you can, to go in the afternoon to a movie that's been out for a really long time, you have the whole theater. Especially in New York City. I mean, when I was younger, I was living in a very small place. Now it's just small. But my early place was very small. So you go to this place, and it's this huge room all to yourself. I mean, it's like you're like a
king
for a little
while. It's like a private screening room.
Yeah. Yes.
Coming up, Smiles talks about what she used to do with many of her days, drink heavily. Explore the Here's the Thing archives. I spoke with the late Elaine Stritch, who wasn't a native New Yorker but became one of the city's most iconic residents. When she retired and finally left the city, she knew what she was going to miss.
The personality of human beings in New York.
Yeah.
They are so opened and they're not watching what they're doing. They're not, you know, they're not
passionate.
Watching their language. They're not watching anything. They're just going through life saying, what? Yeah, all right. Oh, fuck you.
Take a listen at heresthething.org. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Author Iris Smiles is honest about her life. Both of her books humorously deal with very real issues of alienation and self-abuse. Both of these were present in her life even when she was in graduate school and working jobs on the side.
I was teaching creative writing and humanities at the school to undergraduates, and I had picked up some jobs waitressing and as a hostess, but I wasn't good at those, so.
Why?
Because I was drinking really heavily.
Right.
And then they gave me this brunch. Also, I'm just not a good waitress, but they gave me this brunch shift, right? So I would go out and I would drink until 4 in the morning or 5, and then I would have to be there later. And usually it was like, I don't know, I was coming off some kind of bender. And then I had to carry the drinks during brunch, which was really, it's really hard to carry a tray with drinks, and especially when you have the shakes.
Yeah.
So, like, the glasses are rattling all over the place.
Unless you drink one.
I spilled a lot of drinks, or sometimes the customers would catch them in time. You know, because I would lower the tray really slowly.
Maybe people came there. It was kind of a game. See if you can catch the drinks when they.
Well, one of the games was I was so bad at the job that the manager was like, "Are you sure you should be in service?" But then every time he tried to broach the subject of my quitting, I would start to tear up because I was very sensitive and wanted to do well. And then it became sort of a game, like, who am I going to quit, or is he going to fire me?
Did people around you know, like whoever you were close with, friends, family, did they know you had a drinking problem?
Well, it was...
Try to intercede there?
No, because I was really great at drinking. I mean, there was a... That's why it was hard...
Define that.
It was hard to stop. I mean, I was a... That's like pretty much... That was my main thing. That was like my art form.
So the evening would begin how?
Partying.
Home?
Yeah.
A little drink at home?
Yeah, and maybe have a friend over. I don't know. It just sort of, it's not that it would begin. It basically never stopped. You know? So
right.
To say where it begins is like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Birth. But so it was hard to give up because that was so much of my identity, and people around me loved it because I was always giving parties and I was creating a lot of fun. I mean, I wasn't a miserable drink. I was drunk. It was just hurting me.
Right.
And also, I mean, the reason that I gave it up is because I wanted to become something. I realized that, like, you know, you drink and you've created a wonderful time, but what have you made? And so I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to make something.
So when did that change? When did you decide that drinking was not compatible with who you really wanted to be?
Well, it was really becoming harder and harder to keep doing it. I mean, physically, the hangovers were becoming pretty bad. I just started to realize that I was kind of, I was getting further and further away from anything that I ever wanted to do. And I had, you know, big dreams, and I just was not getting anywhere near them. And I figured either I have to revise my dreams, my aspirations, or make a change in my life in order to actually accomplish something.
And you did make that change.
I did. And it was kind of the most exciting, I'd say the biggest adventure and the most exciting time of my life was 5 years I spent, I'd completely retired from social life and I was just kind of writing and living like a monk. I mean, on the outside,
this
it seemed very boring.
This is after graduate school.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're around 26, 25, 26?
I was, I guess, 28, 29.
When you went into the cave?
When I went into the cave. And then I kind of came out 5 years later with a book and happily got it published. And now I'm sort of, you know, trying to be a human again.
So what I wonder is when you go into this kind of cloister, when you go into the cave, why don't you stay there if it was so fruitful, ultimately? What were you missing?
It was great, but I think again it was an extreme and it's not sustainable in the same way that I mean basically I took everything that I was giving to like my drinking and party lifestyle and put it into work, and I don't think that you know the pendulum swings and it has to come back.
Another obsession. Yeah.
Yeah, and so it was good, but now I'm trying to sort of cultivate some kind of balance, and you know I want to have a personal life, so I'm trying to figure that out. Although I'm very intense, so it would be a lot. I long for the cave in truth, but you know it's a new challenge to sort of be balanced in the middle, moderate. But doesn't it sounds like terrible? Who wants to be moderate at anything?
You came out with a book called
Iris Has Free Time.
Right. What did you do? What do you do with a book? If you're a writer and you write a book and your parents aren't at Knopf or something or Simon & Schuster and you're with all of the defining things about who you are, what do you do with that book when you're done? Where do you go with it?
Well, happily, I had met a professor at City College who liked my work and encouraged me to keep writing. And so I showed it to him and then he introduced me or referred me to a few different agents, which means that they, you know, put my cover letter at the top and then rejected me before all of the other people. But then one of them kind of took me on. And so we made our way and got the book out.
Got it out how?
It was published by Counterpoint.
What were those meetings like for you when you're pitching a book or you're selling a book to them? What's it like for you, you know, out of a period of intense isolation, if you will, and now you've got to be a bit more collaborative. Was that difficult for you to collaborate with them?
It was terrible.
Describe that. How much did they want to change your book?
Well, I mean, and that's why it was a little bit of a process. In the beginning, I had seen a couple of agents who liked it, but they were like, yes, but we want it, you need to change it all around and do this. And so that was really scary because after 5 years, you think, well, this is my chance. Do I go agree with them? But I didn't want to change it. I didn't believe in that. So I took a risk and I... Sort of stuck to my guns, found another agent, finally found a publisher who didn't want me to change it. And it was just sort of the same thing with my second book. I think, you know, it's an editor is important, but it has to be the right editor.
In your first book, did you have the right editor? To some degree, even?
Sure.
A woman.
Yes, right. But I think that what I mean is that lots of people in now, I think, especially now, there's this idea of like writing is much more collaborative. And so a lot of people put their hands on it. And I don't think that's a good idea. I think that comes from so many people are going to graduate school for writing. And so they have this idea that they're going to like workshop it and put it through the committee. And the more eyes it has, the better. And I don't think so. I don't think it should be collaborative at all. I think even, you know...
It really can't be, can it?
No, and it gets dulled down, and it should be, you know, individual and full of... I mean, I'd rather see, you know, better that it be imperfect, but extravagant than some kind of, like, measured...
Yeah, homogenized something.
Yeah.
when you've been working on your second book, your second book is coming out.
It just came out a month ago.
And was it the same publishers?
Different. Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Was it better, this experience?
Different. The Counterpoint is an independent publisher, and so I was the big fish there. So they, you know, really gave it a push. But then at the same time, because they're an independent publisher, they have less influence. So now I'm a small fish at a big house.
How's that been?
It's been great. I like them. And I'm very excited because Houghton Mifflin is also the publisher of Cliff's Notes. So I feel like that's one step closer to publishing Cliff Notes for my own book.
You can,
which is important because
you made
people,
a deal to do the Cliff Notes.
Then people won't even have to read my book anymore. Right. They can just study up on the symbolism and the foreshadowing, which is important. Without actually, and just my book could disappear completely.
The title of your first book was
Iris Has Free Time.
Iris Has Free Time came out when?
2013 June.
Not too long ago. And how would you characterize, if at all, how you've changed as a writer since your second book came out, which is called
Dating Tips for the
Dating
Unemployed.
Tips for the Unemployed.
I think that when I write now, I used to have to write a lot more before I found the beginning of something, and now I kind of have a better sense of, I can get there faster. So there's there's less wasted. I'm just, I guess...
You're better at it.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, you're better at it.
Yeah, I'm getting better with practice that happens.
Where do you live now?
Oh, I live in New York City over on the sort of the Middle East side, which is really nice over there. I moved to around Beekman Place, which is, I moved there because I'm getting on in my years, and that's where Auntie Mame lived. So I feel like I'm entering my Mame years, and it's a good place to establish my spinster pad. I really like it.
Do you want to be a spinster? Is that a goal?
No. No.
Do you fear that no one will get you?
Do I fear no one will get me? I guess I would. Yeah, I would like to meet someone.
Do you date men?
I do date men.
And when you date men, when you meet a guy that you like, what do you typically like about them?
Well, that doesn't happen that often. I like.
But on those rare occasions when it does happen, describe that. You want someone who's clever, funny?
No, and I don't generally don't go in for looks. I've noticed I sort of have a pattern of dating kind of like a lot of like hideous creatures.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I guess they just tend to be more interesting or, I don't know. I don't think they're hideous, but I mean, according to the standard.
Right.
The standard. They're not pretty boys.
Right.
But
you don't care.
And I guess I noticed a slight pattern. What I go in for is like a man. I really like men
Hemingway.
Very much. No. Because he was arrogant.
Much.
I hate Hemingway.
Okay. Oh, okay.
I have a real thing against him.
Okay.
But
Mailer.
So, no, I don't like him either.
Okay.
Because I don't like all those pretensions to intellect and all of that. I don't like arrogance.
Okay, sorry.
But so some, I've noticed I have a pattern with sort of like, I guess like dummies, because sometimes, smarter men don't, they don't know how to handle me. They're nervous. But like a guy who's not that bright doesn't know enough to be nervous.
He doesn't know what he's missing. Right?
So he's
doesn't
just
know enough.
So he's sort of like, he's just more
simple,
proactive. Yeah, he's not like doubting. He's not worrying and
more elemental.
Yeah, I don't know.
But you don't care that you're single.
No, I do. I'd like to meet someone. I'd like to meet someone nice.
Wouldn't it be funny if you met your husband in a costume shop somewhere in Mineola?
Oh, that sounds so romantic.
That could be great. Now, before we have you read something for us, what are your dating tips for the unemployed? Because you yourself have never really been unemployed, have you? You when you talk about your life, that arc is working and having a job, whether it defined you, until you can get to the point now where you're a writer.
Well, I've been unemployed. I mean, it hasn't been, even my jobs didn't seem that serious.
Even when you had a job, you didn't
I've
have a job.
I've always felt unemployed, I guess, is
it's
the
a state
thing.
Of mind.
I think so. And that's why I called the book that, because it's not all about being unemployed. But I think it's, the idea, it's it's really, I guess, if you're trying to date when you're unemployed, it's like you're a mess, but you have to make this presentation that you're attractive in some way. And I think I've always felt that way at my core. Even now, when people ask me what I do, and I thought it would all be solved if I could say a writer or a novelist, and now I say, oh, I'm a writer, and I feel embarrassed, and all of a sudden I feel like I'm lying, or it's not true, or I'm not writing enough. So I don't know if that feeling will ever be over. Yeah.
So what are one of your dating tips for the unemployed?
Well, so there's not actually any tips. The book is not actually any tips. It's stories that form a novel about, you know, kind of being in that awkward period and feeling unformed. But there's one piece where the character reads an article about dating tips for the unemployed. And the tips there's two. It's never date anyone more or less miserable than you. That's the one tip.
And they have an equivalency of misery.
Exactly. Because even if you go with someone who is less miserable than you, then eventually, and even if you can fake it for a while, eventually they'll find out that you're more miserable. And you have to be, miserables date each other, non-miserables date each other. How do you determine, this is the next tip, how do you determine who is a miserable and who is a non-miserable? Because everyone goes around and presents themselves as a non-miserable pretty much. And
who's honest about their misery? Yeah, that's important.
Very, very few.
Yeah, lay the cards
and
on the
one
table.
Way that you can determine that is how people answer the question, what do you do? So if you answer it honestly and you say, I'm an accountant or I wait tables, then that person's pretty okay with themselves. But if they answer it with some sort of clever thing, if they say like, you know, I make the toast on the astronaut, whatever. I'm an astronaut toast maker.
Right.
You know, something
I prepare breakfast on the space station.
And they're obvious and they don't actually do that, you know, but they respond with like too much charm, like compulsive charm, almost right. Offensive charm. Like actual happy people don't feel the need to be that charming, which is, by the way, why I am so adorable and charming, because I've spent years right. compensating
Fake.
For my misery. So that's how you can tell. So, for example, if someone responds, if you say, like, on social media, on Facebook, things like that, if it says under occupation, if a person writes blowfish, right? Then that person is definitely miserable. If a person writes bonds trader, that person is not miserable. So the bonds trader and the blowfish will never work out. That's what you need to know.
You need something in between. Do you have a little excerpt you want to read?
I don't know. Let me see what to read.
Whatever amount you read, it's fantastic. Just go with it. Just do whatever you want to do.
Okay, well, since I mentioned, I guess I'll read The Family Politic. Politics, right? Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. My family is downstairs yelling. They're not arguing, that's just how they talk. It's a Greek thing. That's what we say, but the truth is when we visit Greece, people remark on how loud we are. We respond, it's an American thing. I'm in my old room at my parents' house because I just got into a fight with my brother, Teddy. He was going on about the internet spelling the end of physical books. Lowering his voice to just a yell, he said, in the future, no one's going to want your precious little books, Iris. The book will be obsolete. I told him he was wrong, that people will always want books. Then he said, na 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 na, and I lost it and ran upstairs. So now I'm up here, digging out old swimming trophies and dance costumes from under my bed. I have a trophy from 1992 that says Highest Achiever. I dust it off and think about bringing it back to my apartment in Manhattan. Maybe I could turn it into a cigarette holder or something. I try on a blue ballet costume and I'm excited to find it still fits. I look at myself in the mirror and think about Zelda Fitzgerald. She was my age when she took up ballet. Taking stock of my reflection, I understand for the first time her insanity. I turn in my tutu and notice my thighs are thicker than they used to be. I'm an oversized child, a monster of wilted potential. I put on my point shoes and attempt a few poses in front of the mirror. After a while, I change back into my regular clothes and head downstairs. Everyone is standing around the kitchen table, yelling at the top of their lungs, agreeing that Bush has betrayed the party. I hold up a hanger with the tutu on it and ask my mom, "What's the best way to remove wrinkles from tulle?" "What do you want with that old thing now? Throw it out." "No way," I say. "I can't believe you had it all scrunched up in a bag. I could use it for a Halloween costume. Or my author photo. A web magazine is going to publish one of my stories this spring." "Oh, God," she says. "Steam it, maybe. Hang it in the shower." I pull at the blue tulle, worry a loose sequin, then sit at the end of the table and listen. I don't know how to talk to them. All they ever talk about is politics, which I've given up, having decided long ago that cultivating opinions about politics is against my better interests. I lean right economically, which, as a writer, would put me at odds with the artistic and academic communities in which I work. I recognize my views are somewhat paradoxical. For example, idealistically speaking, I'm a rugged individualist. The government is a necessary evil, I like to say, like boyfriends. But practically speaking, were it not for my parents, I would need government handouts more than anyone. I'm prime welfare material. In fact, trying to assuage my father's disappointment in the McCain candidacy last election, my mother told him, "On the bright side, if Obama is elected, the government will help us support Iris." It's pretty well understood in my family that I can't take care of myself, which is why family values are so important to me. It's paramount that I marry so as to preserve my identity as a rugged individualist. If my parents ever cut me loose and I were forced to rely on the state for support, my whole ideology would crumble. I don't approve of social programs. FDR ruined this country with his Pinko rescue plan. Let those in need pull up their socks, I say, all while dreaming of the day that my parents' burden, me, might be transferred to a rich husband, and I might continue to cultivate my pioneer spirit in safety.
Fantastic. Fantastic. What's your favorite holiday?
Halloween, of course.
Are you writing another book now?
Yes, I'm starting a new novel, but I'm completing a volume of light verse, sort of called Girls Who Wear Glasses. It's poems about, love and partying and sex. But they rhyme. It's a sort of updated Dorothy Parker, Ogden Nash kind of thing. Rhyming, I mean, who doesn't love that?
Iris Smiles' Dating Tips for the Unemployed is available in bookstores now.
Oh, I forgot to give you your prize.
Oh, my God, I'm so glad you reminded me.
Okay.
Now, tell our listeners what exactly it is I'm getting. I won the blurb contest.
The National Blurb Contest, that's right.
For your book.
For my book.
And the blurb contest, the award ceremony was held where?
At the Econo Lodge in New York City, in the lobby, next to the ice machine, at 6 a.m. during their free continental breakfast.
I was so sorry I couldn't make it. I told you I was crushed.
I'm sorry you couldn't make it, too.
Did you accept on my behalf?
I did.
May I see it?
Yes. So this is your whole prize package. It comes with an Iris Has Free Time bag.
Oh, my God. I mean, talk about marketing.
And then here's your award for your actual blurb.
Oh, I love it.
And, of course,
it's a signed copy of the book?
A signed copy of the book with your blurb printed on the back.
Now, in the book that's been published, is my blurb on the back of the book?
That's the book.
There's not an alternate version.
No,
you didn't just have these made up for me as a gift.
No.
I'm on the book.
You've made it.
Have you ever eaten Entenmann's?
Oh, yes, I love them.
I didn't read this book and I didn't have to. On the cover, it said Iris Smiles, and that's more than enough for me. Like logos for Coca-Cola, Fritos, and Entenmann's. Iris's name assures me that what's inside is so yummy.
I'm Alec Baldwin, and this is Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.